Rav's Chidushei Torah, I just want to introduce with a biographical sketch of the Rav. Now, I have to be honest with you that what I know today about the Rav's life is a lot more than I knew the last time I did this. It's because of my research. When I say to you, it's in my book, when I reheard the tape of last week's lecture, I sounded like an idiot. You know, every third word I said to you, it's in my book. What I'm trying to say is that while I'm saying something which perhaps the world does not know, when my book will appear, Be'ezrat Hashem, you'll see all the footnotes and you'll be able to get all the background of why I'm saying what I'm saying. Obviously, I don't want to go into all the details now because I just want to finish the biography. If I can't finish today, at least I want to finish it next week. Now, to refurbish your memories, and by the way, I'm passing around the class list, so just see. Brian, I'll leave you in charge of that list and just see that everyone signs in when they come in if they're in the class. Now, as I said last week, the Rav was born in Pruzhana, or Pruzhin as it's popularly called, and he's born into a family with great tradition. It's not easy to bear the Soloveitchik name. On his mother's side, of course, he's a Feinstein, and the very mention of the word Soloveitchik and Feinstein, I think, says it all. What's fascinating about the Rav's youth is the influence of Chabad, and this cannot be discarded, because there's no doubt in my mind, and I have in my book many times where the Rav says it himself, that the Rav would have never become the Rav if not for the influence of Chabad. In other words, there's no question in my mind that the greatness in learning, the greatness in bris, the greatness as a Rosh Yeshiva, the Rav would have achieved with or without Chabad. But all that we know that the Rav is unique for, the Hashkafa, the Drush, the philosophy, everything that makes the Rav, everything that placed him in the YU world, if I can put it that way, is a result of that Chabad Rebbe. And they know two ways about it, and the Rav said that on many occasions, and I'll document it, where you'll be able to hear the Rav speaking word by word and telling you about it in the book Be'ezrat Hashem. Now, that's one great influence. The second influence, of course, is his father, his grandfather, the whole Bris tradition, this goes without saying. And on that level, the Rav was, I would say, the premier spokesman for the Bris tradition in our generation. See, what's amazing about the Rav, and all of us who studied with him, all say the same thing, that from the classroom alone, you never knew that the Rav was anything more than a Briska Rosh Yeshiva. When he was in the classroom giving shiur, we're not talking now about graduate school, but when he was in the classroom giving shiur, you absolutely did not know that the Rav had any mastery beyond Shas and Paiskim. On that level, he was no different than Rav Aaron Cutler, no different than Rav Moshe Feinstein, no different than Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, and it was simply, when you look back now, and I studied with the Rav many years and intimately knew the Rav, never was there a trace of anything beyond the Rambam, the Raivad, the Rashi, the Tosfot, the Briska Derech. And on that level, he was the outstanding exponent. I know that Rav Aaron Cutler, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, used to send Rav Schneer in the early 50s to sit in the Rav Shurim at the yeshiva. And when I learned in Lakewood, I was very close to Rav Schneer's. It's hard for me to realize he's gone. It's very sad. I've seen, as a matter of fact, it's very sad for me doubly because I couldn't attend Rav Schneer Cutler's funeral. I was up in Beirut at the time. It was in the middle of the Lebanese war. And he literally was buried on the day that I reached Beirut. And he was, to me, when I learned in Lakewood, I was particularly close to Rav Schneer. I was a Ben Bayit in his house. I mean, I remember like yesterday, he, his wife, our discussions. And Rav Schneer said to me that when he went to the Rav Shurim, you know, as far as the Torah goes, he said, nothing like it. Brisk, the analysis. What bothered Rav Shneur, he said he didn't feel the boys were that serious, you see. He looked around the YU classroom and no one wore hats, no one dressed in yeshivish fashion. So I imagine in the early 50s, and the fellows, you know, had secular things on their mind, college. So he made that comment to me that the Rav was heads and shoulders above the generation, but he didn't feel the boys were that serious. But on that level, the Rav was brisk, kulo brisk, and you had no idea, you know, anything beyond it. Now, then, of course, comes his mother. And this comes out now with Shulamit in the Rav's sister's book, in Dr. Shulamit Meiselman's volume. And just yesterday, I had a very long talk for the first time in years with Rabbi Moshe Meiselman. Now that his mother's book has appeared, everyone's in need of a friend, if you understand what I'm saying. So we had a long talk about the book. But the book is very fascinating. And there's no doubt in my mind that the mother was very open-minded to begin with. And this is something you have to understand. There was Haskalah, there was literature. There were reasons that people already were leaving the ghetto and the home she came from. The way the volume describes Rebellia and the home she was raised in, there was a lot of open-mindedness and a lot of Haskalah, but combined with Torah. In other words, there wasn't that there was a rebellion, it was more of a combination. Now, did she win over Reb Moshe? Didn't she win over Reb Moshe? It would appear from Shulamit Meiselman's volume, and Baruch Hashem that Aaron Rakefet was zoicha to the same conclusion without having seen it with my own eyes, but it would appear from Shulamit Meiselman's volume that ultimately Reb Moshe came around. And that's what I said, to me it was a tremendous eye-opener when I discovered that the Rav attended university in Warsaw already, in his parents' house. So this takes the sales out of people. You can give me the list if everyone's here. And Yoshua, please close the door. That this takes the sales, all these people that say that the Rav would have never gone to university if not for his mother, his father didn't approve. By the time the Rav went to university, I believe his father approved. You see it from the book. And once I can prove, and I'm able to prove, that the Rav attended university in Warsaw, it's impossible that the Rav would have gone without his father's acquiescence. Impossible. It just couldn't happen otherwise. Now, details of how Pesha influenced Reb Moshe and finally got him to come around, you'll read the book. You'll have a memoir right before your eyes. It's fascinating. When you'll read the book, you'll understand what I'm about to say now. Aaron Rakefet intuitively feels that when HaRabban at Pesha calls in Reb Moshe to see what the Rav is studying without his approval, I have a feeling she planted the sperm. In other words, according to the book, the way Shulamit describes it, she said to Reb Moshe, she said, the Rav is studying Haskalah anyway, whether you approve or not. And she knocks on the door, they come in and the Rav is busy studying Haskalah. So Reb Moshe saw he's studying clandestinely, he saw he better go along with it. Brian, I feel, it's only a guess, that the Rav Tzimpesha said to the Rav, listen, your father's driving me crazy. Let's set him up. I want you at 3 o'clock in the afternoon to sit in the room with your Haskalah books open, and I'll bring the Tata in to see. So I think she set him up. I can't believe it happened just coincidentally. But nevertheless, I stand on what I said, that Rav Moshe had to approve. And here we have the turning point. The Rav goes to Berlin. Now, again, when I say this is the turning point, what I mean the turning point? In Europe, everyone in Europe knew that the Rav was a genius of geniuses. Reb Chaim already spoke about his grandson, the famous story with the quintrasim that Reb Moshe used to send Reb Chaim of his Einikel's Torah. Reb Chaim ran into Reb Simcha Zelig. We have eyewitnesses, you know, they're no longer alive, but I grew up hearing these stories from eyewitnesses, how Reb Chaim would go into Reb Simcha Zelig, the Brisket Dayan, who I spoke about Sunday, and show him the volumes, and this is what my grandson is capable of. And everyone knew that the Rav, and that's the famous letter of the Rav Avram Dov Ber Kahana Shapiro, the Kovna Rav, where he says that the Rav has the spirit of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, his grandfather, Halacha Kamoso. There's no question the Rav's name was very great. Now, going to Berlin, of course, is the start of the, if I can say, the split, the cleavage. Like when I learned in Lakewood, they couldn't deny the Rav's godless and Torah, but they said, had he not gone to Berlin, what he would have been. You understand? This is the split. And again, Reb Moshe walks to the train station, no doubt in my mind that he approved what the Rav was doing. He was happy. He understood there was a new tomorrow, and Berlin was a tremendous pull at that time. The fact that Berlin was such a tremendous pull, you see from who studied there at the Rav's time. No, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Yitzchak Kuttner, Nechama Leibovitch, the Rav. I mean, imagine the Kochot that were pulled to Berlin. So you can see it was a beacon of enlightenment that shone like a beautiful tower of light to these East European young people who wanted to see what is enlightenment all about, what is knowledge all about, what is secular knowledge all about. And the Rav goes to Berlin. Now, what's the year that he goes to Berlin? Here, there's a problem. Rabbi Lichtenstein, in his initial biography of the Rav, and Moshe, that was the biography, the first time that anything was ever written about the Rav was in 1962, the biography for the B'nai B'rit series. Rabbi Lichtenstein takes the year 1925. Aaron Rothkopf, an encyclopedia for the Encyclopedia Judaica on the Rav, stands on Rabbi Lichtenstein's shoulders and writes the year 1925. Baruch Hashem, Aaron Rothkopf disappeared from the scene. So when he was when Aaron Rothkopf was attacked by Manfred Lehman in 1994, Rothkopf wasn't around to take it on the chin. But Manfred Lehman, and I found out the whole story, it's really a student of mine, Ralph Shapiro, who went to the University of Berlin and came up with documents. The Germans are very meticulous, and all the documents of the Rav's file survive, including personal letters in the Rav's handwriting, and including a curriculum vita that the Rav wrote before he gets his doctorate, in which he states he went to Berlin in 1926. Manfred Lehman thereby attacked Aaron Rothkopf. Aaron Rothkopf thereby went running in tears to Baron Lichtenstein, and he asked Baron Lichtenstein, Aaron, didn't you show this to the Rav? The Rav read your work. I mean, there's no comment. And Aaron said, look, it was in the year. Everyone knows, 1925. No, the Rav never commented to him. It was unimportant. Anyway, I would accept the fact that it's 1926 because a document written in the 1930s, it makes no sense that the Rav should change the 25 to 26. So I would accept the fact that we have to correct history and put it 1 year later, not 1925, but 1926. Now, the Rav comes to Berlin, and he gets involved. Two topics attract him, mathematics and philosophy. He gets involved in the whole question, what is knowledge, a priori knowledge? This gets, if you're familiar with Immanuel Kant and his entire philosophic school, later followed by Hegel, there's a tremendous question. Is there knowledge that's independent of man? In other words, knowledge that is built into the very essence of the existential existence of the human being in this world. And of course, if there's any knowledge that is a priori, it has to be mathematics and physics. And that's the theme that the Rav gets involved with. Now, he majors in philosophy, minors in mathematics, ultimately does a doctorate on philosophy, and I'll tell you about his doctorate in a second. What's interesting is, and this is what Rabbi Lichtenstein writes about in his article, and it would seem that from anecdotal evidence that it's absolutely correct, the Rav originally wanted to write his doctorate on the Rambam and deal with the Rambam and Aristotle. And he wanted to deal with the interaction between the two. It seems that at the University of Berlin, La Brillot, there was no one capable of guiding such a doctorate. People who knew Aristotle and Socrates and ancient Greek philosophy, that was not a problem. People who knew Maimonides inside out, that was a problem. And that's why the doctorate was not done on Aristotle and Maimonides, which, of course, I don't have to tell you, is a great loss for us. According to Aaron Lichtenstein, his topic was to have been Maimonides and Plato, and its thesis that general Maimonidean scholarship had erred in seeing Maimonides as a confirmed Aristotelian. In other words, many people take for granted that Maimonides follows the Aristotle school as developed by Plato, and the Rav was out to disprove it. They could find no one to sit on a committee from the point of view of Maimonides. And that's why this doctorate didn't get off the floor. Now, what the Rav finally wrote on was on the metaphysical system, the epistemology of Hermann Cohn. Now, Hermann Cohn was a very famous Jewish philosopher, a disciple in a philosophic sense of Hegel and Kant, and he devoted his life to the source of knowledge. This was the theme of his philosophy. What was amazing about Hermann Cohn is that all his life he was not a practicing Jew. He was identified as a Jew. There was very little observance. He was total philosophic. Later in life, he was called to Warsaw and asked to help the Jews in Warsaw, which was the largest city. This was the heart of Jewish enlightenment in Poland and probably had the largest population of Jews of any city in Eastern Europe. And there was an enlightened element there that wanted to establish a scientific school, a Hechschule for das Wissenschaftsjudentum, a scientific school for Jewish studies. Cohn was called in to help them with the philosophic department, and he was overwhelmed by what he saw, and he became much more observant, and for him, the whole concept of God, instead of being a philosophic concept, became much more tangible. And by the way, this not only happened to Hermann Cohn, it happened to many good people who were raised in Reform, semi-Reform. They visited Eastern Europe, and they were overwhelmed by the intensity of Jewish life. Jewish life became real to them, and to a certain degree, they became Balei Tshuva. Can anyone give an example from the American rabbinate? One of the most famous of American rabbis, he was the first actually American-born Orthodox rabbi, was Bernard Drachman. And that mean anything to you? Read his autobiography, The Unfailing Light. He was rabbi of where Arthur Schneier is rabbi today. What do they call it? Park Avenue East. It was called Zichron Ephraim for many years. He was originally sent to Germany to study in the Reform Seminary to be a Reform rabbi. From Germany, he happened to visit Warsaw, took a trip, wanted to see Eastern Europe. Came to Eastern Europe and saw Jews benching on a Wednesday afternoon with more kavana than they benched in America on Rosh Hashanah, and he became an Orthodox Jew. Later came back to America, became one of the leaders of Orthodoxy, one of the founders of he was one of the first teachers in Yeshivas Rebbe Shalchan, and he taught homiletics. Later went on to be one of the early members, although he was an old man already, of the Rabbinical Council of America, etc. And so what happened to Hermann Cohn is, shall I put it this way, it is not out of the ordinary. And interestingly, the Rav did his doctorate, because the Rav never met Hermann Cohn. Hermann Cohn died in 1918. But the Rav did his doctorate on his epistemological system, which means the frame of reference he used in his philosophic system dealing with reality, with mathematics, with physics. Now, this preoccupation with mathematics and physics and science remains with the Rav throughout his life. And for instance, if you study Ish Halakha, you will see how it's a basic theme in Ish Halakha. Time and again, he will come back to mathematics and physics. You'll also see it in The Lonely Man of Faith, Adam 1, Adam 2, Conquering the World, medicine, the noble gesture of knowledge, of cognition. Time and again, the Rav will come back, and you can see the influence of his years in Berlin. And I don't think it ever left him. I remember all the years, even when he gave, you see, by the 1970s, what's fascinating, if you follow the Rav's development outside of the classroom, when you read Ish Halakha, for instance, when you read, you can't read it when you study, Ish Halakha, you're studying a universal text. You understand what I'm saying? The problems the Rav deals with in Ish Halakha are universal problems. The man of halakha vis-a-vis the universal man of faith. What is faith? What is religion? What does religion have to establish in the human being? How does a religious person lead his life? These are universal problems. How does a religious person view the world? Let me tell you a little story. Bring it home to you. Drive it home. True story. You know the way professors are. They always want to show that they're smarter than anybody else. They're bigger than anybody else. This is a sickness professors have. It was that way in my time. It's probably still true today. BMT student stays in Israel. We influenced him not to go back. Goes to Bar Ilan. Meets me one day at the Kotel Friday night. Everyone knows they can find me at the Kotel Friday night. Meets me one day. We're walking out together. And he tells me his professor in Bar Ilan ripped apart the Rav because his Ish Halakha is studied in Catholic theological seminaries. I told him, go back and tell your professor, why is he ripping apart the Rav? He better start ripping apart the Old Testament because they studied that before they studied the Ish Halakha.
He went back and he told it to the professor. The professor was going crazy. He had nothing to answer. But the truth is, any good Catholic and any good Protestant and any person who has theological inclinations, just as you study the Old Testament, you can very well study the Ish Halacha, because it deals with universal problems that every religious person has to ask himself. Obviously, the Rav, this is the greatness of the Rav, and again, I have to take for granted, you know, the Ish Halacha. Without knowing the Ish Halacha, you can't breathe there. But how we contrast the Ish Halacha with the Ish Hadat, the universal religious man vis-a-vis the Halachic man. And it's overwhelming. To me, there are passages in Ish Halacha, I shake, I shiver. I mean, he reaches all-time heights. That's the Rav's magnum opus from the philosophic point of view. Even where he discusses the Musa movement, I just call it to your attention, that discussion of the Musa movement and the Ish Halacha, I've never, ever found anything that equaled it. Because the truth of the matter is, why was Musa so opposed? What's wrong with Musa? Talk about the Musa movement. I hope I have to take for granted, you know, Torah history. I'm not talking Musa today. Today there's no Musa movement. People who study Musa, it's a joke. They take out 20 minutes a day and they study Orchat Tzadikim. But I lived Musa. I know what I grew up in the Musa. I grew up in Slabatka. Rabbeinu Shelolem, what's wrong with Musa? What's wrong with Musa? The last time I got angry. One second, let's work on those names or you'll be angry at me. Has everyone signed in? Has everyone signed in? Please pass this back. What's your name? First name. Give me a first name. Kalman? Kalman, sure. But you're not on the list. You're not on that list. This is a new list. This is today's class. Kalman, I want to ask you, what's wrong with Musa? Ribbono Shel Olam, what's wrong with Musa? The last time I got angry was 1972. Don't tell me Baruch Hashem. Just tell me it's the result of learning Musa. The last time I got angry was 1972. Stephen, the last time I flunked a student was 1962. You understand? The last time I got angry was 1972. Woodrow, Aaron, I never saw a guy with so many beautiful names. The last time I flunked a student was 1962. So what's wrong with Musa? Musa, the last time I didn't compromise with my wife was 1960. Okay? That's all a result of the Musa movement. What's wrong with Musa? Why was there so much opposition? Why did the Yitzchok Hanan, we're talking, those of you that heard my class on Sunday, Ribbono Shel Olam, I don't have to apologize for Mayor, for Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan Spector. The truth is, I should have made everyone stand up on Sunday. The minute I mentioned his name, the first time, you have to stand up out of cupboard. What's wrong? What's wrong, Akiva, with Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan Spector, that he was so opposed to Musa, Kelman? What's wrong? What's wrong? What can be wrong with Musa? And Kelman? Kelman Winnick, right? Okay. Kelman Shur. Where's Kelman Shur? Kelman and Kelman. Kalman, the Rav raises the issue in Ish Halacha. And what he says there, I mean, I'll say Hamazleik, is that Musa, as it began, utilized the universal technique of religion. What's the universal technique of religion? Have you ever heard a Catholic priest speak on Sunday morning? Have you ever heard a Protestant minister, Kalman? They scare the hell out of you. Dante's Inferno. The reason you have to be religious is that you shouldn't rot in purgatory. That is universal approach. Ish Halacha, Kalman, the greatness of man. We're not religious out of fear. Being religious out of fear is the lowest level of human existence. We are religious out of love, out of acknowledging the greatness of the human being, who we are, what we are, what we're capable of. Gad l'tadam, Ish Halacha. And now you know why they opposed Musa? Stephen, how did Reb Yisrael Salanter begin? What were his techniques at times? Pardon me, to scare the hell out of you. Remember? A little Musa cloise. No light, no windows, just candles. The only svarim, Musa svarim, my Murray Musa, to learn in a melancholy call, in a Murray Bond atmosphere.
Damaya in bata Uliana tahole. Ay, Uliana tahole. Lama kama faifa varima.
Scare the person. And he ran. The Rav says so beautifully that the Gedolei Yisrael intuitively cringed. They recalled from Musa that was on a universal method. That's not the Jewish method. We don't scare people. And the Rav says so insightfully, this is why when Slabodka began, knew what characterized Slabodka? Stephen, I glance, write it nicely. Stephen, what characterized Slabodka? What characterized Slabodka? Gadlut Adam, the greatness of man. Rav Natan Zvi Finkel, in Slabodka, you had a dress, the most modern dress, the latest styles, beautiful ties. You took a haircut, left hair on in front. I wish I had it to leave on today, but that's a different story. But Smach Bachur B'Yaldutecha, Gadlut Adam, Ben Torah's a prince. And the whole thrust of the Slabodka Musa was not Shiflut Adam, not putting the man down, putting the man up. That's why Gedolei Yisrael reconciled themselves with Musa. Rabbi Yisrael Salantis Musa at times was too moribund. Later, as the Rav says, when Musa developed Yoshua, you see the Rav's words? When Musa developed Yoshua and it matured, these were his words, Hatunua hit bagra. Well, I don't have to tell you, gentlemen, a paragraph like that, and I'm not giving you all the details, it would take me an hour, that's where he describes Reb Chaim and his fear of death, and the meeting with Reb Chaim, with Reb Meir Berlin, he says, Feta, you know, Reb Chaim, he describes that he's looking at the sunset in Odessa, and he's, the sunrise in Odessa, and he's so disturbed. And they were, and Reb Meir Berlin, Reb Chaim's, I think he was Reb Chaim's uncle, although he was 50 years younger than Reb Chaim, but I think he was his uncle, because Reb Meir Berlin, I don't have time now to work it out. It was Reb Chaim's uncle. This was the Netziv's son from his second marriage, etc. Reb Chaim was the Netziv's grandson-in-law. Reb Meir Berlin was probably 50 years younger than Reb Chaim, but he was Reb Chaim's uncle. But he says to Reb Chaim, whom he called uncle, it was the reverse, uncle-nephew, but they reversed it. He says, why are you so disturbed? What's bothering you this morning? And Reb Chaim says, look at that beautiful sunrise and imagine man has to die. And he shows how Gedolei Yisrael couldn't tolerate death. Just the opposite. Death frightened them. But Gadlut Adam lifted them. And this whole paragraph, this is universal. There's no two ways about it. You know what's amazing? By the 1960s into the 70s, every talk the Rav is given outside of this year, where he gives the RCA talks and the public talks, he's only dealing basically with Jewish topics, with Talmud Torah, Torah Shabbal Peh, women's lib, and you can see the difference. Because in the 20s into the 30s, he was unaffected by Talmidim. His mind could soar where he wanted to go. By the 50s, into the 60s, into the 70s, he has to meet the needs of his students. He's the Rabban Shel Klal Yisrael. And now already the talks are much more centered about topics that are uniquely Torah topics, uniquely Jewish. Bayim don't have to worry about Torah Shabbat Peh. But even where these talks are uniquely Jewish, time and again, he comes back to mathematics and physics and Reb Chaim's approach, and he compares it to philosophical, to the secular philosophical system and the coining of words, etc. So you see that influence of Berlin, of philosophy, which all goes back to the Chabad Rebbe, remained with the Rav until his final days as a Rebbe, his final functioning days. Even if it was a Jewish topic, a limited topic, but the influence was still there. And you'll see it when we cite lectures out of the 60s into the 70s, you'll see it time and again. But it's interesting. In the 30s into the 40s, his topics were much more universal. As he feels the pressure of his students and his position in life, much more uniquely Jewish. Now, that's as far as his doctorate. The other factor of Berlin is very fascinating. Who were his friends?
Who did he keep company with? What was his atmosphere? And here I think the key to understanding this is the little introduction. The little introduction, Yeshua Engelson, Hillel Lake Tzion, Avna Shapiro, Kalman Winnick, and Ari Israel. Ari, that's you in back. Ari Israel. Ari, are you familiar with the Ish Halacha? What is very interesting, right before he begins the essay, he quotes a Maimar Chazal. It's like a little introductory Maimar Chazal that stands by itself. And that Maimar Chazal, the Rav Ari could not have picked a more revealing Maimar Chazal. Quotes the Gemara in Sota, Daf Lamed Vav Amid Bet. And what is the Gemara talking about? It's talking about, of course, Yosef HaTzadik. And we all know that Yosef HaTzadik, Potiphar, tries to entice him. And according to Chazal, there's a machloket on that famous day when he went in to see her. Did he go to sin, or did he just go to attend to his duties in the house? And according to one opinion, he finally was going to succumb. He finally was going to sin. And what a Chazal say in the Sechet Sota Lamed Vav Amid Bet, Diyot Asha, Vata Diyuk No Shel Aviv, Vinerelo B'chalon, that he was about to sin. Yosef HaTzadik was about to sin, was about to give it all up, was about to succumb. And at that moment, in the window, Ari, he saw the dmut of his father, the Demut of Yaakov Avinu. And that's the way the Rav introduces Isha Halacha. And if I can just interpret it, and I don't think it requires much psychology here to interpret it, what it means is very simple. The Rav here is telling us he comes to Berlin, comes to the city of enlightenment, of knowledge. It's hard to believe what came out of Berlin just a few years later. And by the way, in my book, I cite the Rav talking about it, where he talks about some of his own professors who later became leaders of the Nazi philosophical movement, professors with whom he was very close, got along fabulously. He was, as the Rav says, I was a good student. And those very professors, a decade later, were writing propaganda for Hitler against the Jews. But this is Berlin, the early, mid-20s. It's like a tremendous sun that's shining. And Kalman, you can be blinded by the sun. It's overwhelming. And the Mukta Yuknoshel, his father, his family, his heritage, he couldn't leave. He had to remain a solid, good Jew, and just the opposite. He had to take his secular knowledge and use it to interpret Judaism, to write a masterpiece like Ish Halacha within a philosophical framework that every philosopher in the world will have to contend with. Now, this, the Mukta Yukno Shel Aviv, explains, and here I come to what is the heart of today's lecture, and perhaps the biggest chiddush in that sense, and everyone from the family that has heard me on this and read what I've written about this says I hit the nail on the head. And it's very fascinating. The world makes a mistake. You look into the Encyclopedia Judaica, and you take a look into the Judaica, and you look up the entry for Reb Chaim Heller. You look up the entry, talks about Reb Chaim Heller, it's volume 8 of the Encyclopedia Judaica, where they brought me an aliyah, I have to be maketoyva, but it doesn't mean I can't correct the mistake. And they list in the entry Reb Chaim Heller that among his students was Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik in Berlin. This is a mistake. The Rav was never really a student of Reb Chaim Heller. The Rav said it 1,000 times over. He would say, "The Welt macht a Teus. The world is making a mistake. Ich hab gehad nein ein Rebbe. I had only one Rebbe, my father." And the world constantly attributed that Reb Chaim Heller was the Rav's Rebbe. It's not so. The Rav came to Berlin a gone idea. The Rav came to Berlin, he was writing Chidushei Torah every week and sending them back to his father. He was totally immersed in learning, a giant of Torah.
chas v'chalila, it's not that Reb Chaim Heller was a Rebbe. As far as his learning went, he didn't need a Rebbe, and there was nothing a Rebbe could give him at that point. But Reb Chaim Heller was something else to him. He was a father image, a father prototype, a Rebbe prototype. Reb Chaim Heller was the demuk de yukno shel aviv that appeared in the window. And this is exactly the relationship between the Rav and Reb Chaim. You see, in Berlin, he finds an individual who is exactly like his father, exactly like his Zaydas, exactly like Reb Chaim Brisker. He finds an individual that is entirely great in Torah, a gon shebegoinim, a tzaddik shebetzaddikim, a chassid shebechassidim, and a master of secular knowledge, of biblical criticism, of Wissenschaft des Judentum. He finds a man who's heads and shoulders above the generation. And he becomes the relationship between Reb Chaim Heller and the Rav. It engenders into a relationship that Reb Chaim Heller becomes the father figure the Rav is lacking in a tangible fashion in Berlin. And the Rav becomes the son that Reb Chaim Heller never had. As those of you know, Reb Chaim Heller had the Rakefet Shita, Rashi Shita. He had three daughters, no sons. The Rav became the son he never had, and Reb Chaim Heller became the father figure for the Rav, and this relationship becomes basic, focal in the Rav's life. Now, who was Reb Chaim Heller? And here I come back when the Rav passed on. Again, I gave a hesped here. I began my hesped. The Rav's death was not shocking, but it was traumatic. And that sentence was quoted quite widely because I made the point. The Rav, from 1985 on, basically the Rav didn't function. So we all knew that it was only a question of time. He got worse and worse and worse by the late 1980s. The Rav was not even in this world anymore. He was totally out of it. There were no moments of lucidity, none whatsoever. So when the Rav died, no one was shocked, but it was traumatic. An era had ended. An era had ended. Everything has come to an end. And not only that, his own students, I don't know if they're Talmidim here, Reb Heschel Shechta, but Reb Heschel's beard is a result of the Rav's death. Because what happens when your Rebbe dies, suddenly you wake up and you say, wow, the world is leaning on me. I'm no longer a kid today. I'm part of the Pleitat Sofrehim. It's a very sad thought for me personally, but I have to live with it. I meet people who, whenever I travel, people latch onto me and say, Rebbe, we want to, and they say, you're a living link with the Rav. You knew the Rav as he was, etc. It's a very sad thought, but this is the reality of life. This is the reality of life. And Reb Heschel, I'm telling you, those of you that are his Talmidim can appreciate what I'm saying, that beard represents the fact that with the Rav's demise, he subconsciously or consciously recognizes that he's going to be one of 10 main Talmidim who now are going to represent the Rav to the world. Now, when the Rav died, so in the Hespedim, everyone agreed that the Rav's Hespedim for others, he reached heights in Hesped that no one reached in our generation. It may be from the time of Chazal no one reached. I don't want to overstate the case. In particular, there are two Hespedim, and here I differ with Rabbi Lichtenstein. Rabbi Lichtenstein said at his Hesped that the Rav's Hesped for the Brisker Rav was the most unique Hesped that he ever gave, that was ever given. Ma dodimi dodeich. I feel that the Rav's Hesped for Reb Chaim Heller is the greatest, most unique Hesped he ever gave. And I'll tell you why. And I told this to Reb Aaron. The Hesped on his uncle, the Hesped on his uncle is limited to Brisk. It's a Hesped on Brisk. The Hesped on Reb Chaim Heller is all of Judaism. That's the Hesped where the Rav developed the Pleitat Sofrekim, which I think is the greatest Hashkafic Dashanut that we ever heard from the Rav. And I've met people in Israel who are no fans of YU and the Rav, etc. And I remember one of them telling me, he says, I'm not a follower of your Rebbe, he says to me. There's a Michlalas, one of the faculty there at the time. But he says to me, Dad, Hesped and Reb Chaim Heller, nothing equals it in the 20th century. And the Pleitat Sofrehim. And you can see from that Hesped why the Rav was so close to Reb Chaim.
For him, Reb Chaim brought his father back to life, brought his grandfather back to life. For him, Reb Chaim was a living figure in Berlin, and it paved the way that there's no contradiction, and you can remain a great Lithuanian and concomitantly enjoy and partake of the big Western world. Reb Chaim was the demut d'yukno shel aviv, was the prototype he needed, was the most salient figure that the Rav came in contact with during his 6-7 years in Berlin. And it's just an amazing relationship. And let me now tell you a few words about Reb Chaim, then I want to continue with the relationship. What's your name? Do I have your name here? I don't have the name, right? You're in the other class too. Danny, D-A-N-I, how do you spell it? D-A-N, the normal way, Danny Roth. I have it Cyril Roth in Midrashet. Any relationship? No, but Roth, one half my name. One half my name. Danny, you see, who is Reb Chaim Heller? And this is interesting. What I'm going to tell you, you're going to hear something interesting that you, again, you may be yet a little young to appreciate what I'm saying, but someday you'll say, wow, the Rebbe hit the nail on the head. Reb Chaim Heller was a Polish Jew who was a child wonder. By his bar mitzvah, he knew all of Shas, and he knew all of Paiskim, and all of Bavli Yerushalmi, and he spoke and learning with the Netziv, and with Reb Chaim, and with the that entire rebellion of the Rav of Ludz, the Ludz Rav Meisels, rebellion Meisels, that whole generation, Reb Yitzchak Chanan Spekta, and the generation afterwards, and he also got involved with secular study and mastered languages and ancient texts and ancient languages, biblical criticism, and wrote unbelievable volumes against biblical criticism, edited the Rambam, the Sefer Mitzvah. The only Sefer Mitzvah that the Rav would use was Reb Chaim Heller's edition of the Sefer Mitzvah. That was the edition that the Rav used. I have a copy, but I think I have one. I have two copies. One I have in my own library, and one I gave to my middle son-in-law, who's you know full time into learning. And that was Reb Chaim Heller. Then after World War I, he saw that in Europe there was no future, so he came up with the idea he would develop what he called the Beit Medrash Elyon in Berlin. What was the purpose of the Beit Medrash Elyon? The Beit Medrash Elyon was to take the best of the East European graduates of the various yeshivat and expose them to secular study, to Wissenschaft, and enable them, if I may use a YU word, to synthesize between both worlds. And that's how Reb Chaim gets to Berlin. That's the Beit Medrash Elyon. But Danny, there's only one problem. The Beit Medrash Elyon never really succeeded. It existed on paper in Berlin. It had some students. I met students who studied there. I knew Rabbanim who yet studied there, who were Rabbanim in America afterwards. And it could never really succeed. You know why it couldn't succeed, Kalman? For one simple reason. In order for that type of institution to succeed, the student had to be a potential Reb Chaim Heller. How many geniuses do you find like Reb Chaim Heller? Follow me. Had he had a student like Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, so with Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, he would have succeeded. He never really had any great success. By its very nature, the Beis Medrash Elyon was limited to students it could accept, and even more so, it's like studying with Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. Those of you that know Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, I'm talking about the Rav's son, I don't know what he's like today, but he once gave shiurim in the yeshiva. It didn't last more than 6 months because his demands upon the students were such that there was no way they could keep up with him. He gave shiurim in zroyim. He wanted them to look up every zoological text and botanic text. Before he dealt with the Mishnayot and zroyim, you had to know 100 hours worth of secular subjects. No, only a Reb Chaim Soloveitchik can keep up
with a Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. You understand what I'm saying? These are gifted people. Only a Reb Chaim Heller could study with a Reb Chaim Heller. So the institution didn't really amount to a tremendous success story. But the Hashgacha Pratit is overwhelming because God brought together Reb Chaim Heller and the Rav under one roof at that time. Now, they were very good friends. The Rav constantly spoke with him in learning, constantly discussed topics with him. The Rav sat before him as an Eved Bifnei Rabo, as the Gemara says, Shulya Denagra, in front of the master, like an apprentice in front of the master. But the relationship was not formal. It's not in the Rebbe sense. It already was more of a Talmud Chaver, because when the Rav came to Reb Chaim Heller, he himself was a giant. Now, this relationship continues. Reb Chaim Heller is saved from Hitler, comes to America, the late 30s, and here, if you hadn't seen it with your own eyes, you couldn't comprehend how deep the Rav's love and respect was for Reb Chaim Heller. And let me tell you what, there's too many eyewitnesses to. The Rav would give the outside Russia for his father. And thousands of people would be seated. And the atmosphere would be, how can I describe it? Lav me'olam hadein. It would be like Gan Eden. And the Rav would be warming up into the drasha. And Reb Chaim Heller would walk in. He was an old man already. In front of 3,500 people, the Rav would stop the drasha, go off the bima, take Reb Chaim by the hand, talk with him. You would hear him ask him how he is, this. Lead him to a seat up front. The Rav would see that there'd be a seat saved for him. Take his coat, hang up his coat, and only afterwards go back and continue the drasha. Whoever saw that saw Kavod HaTorah. And that's why the world thought it was a Rebbe. It wasn't a Rebbe in the formal sense, but it was a Rebbe prototype, a father image. Particularly, the Rav's father dies in 1941, January 41. Remember, from 1941 to 1960, Reb Chaim Heller was the Rav's father image, was the prototype of a father. And that relationship was very deep, very intense. Now, what the world doesn't know, and what unfortunately I am not allowed to write about, I don't know why, but those close, Karov Lamalchut know, the Rav, you think this was only a story of Kavod? Out of Kavod. The Rav supported Reb Chaim Heller all the years he was in the United States. What was Reb Chaim Heller going to do in America? Could you imagine a man like this? What, are you going to make him a rabbi of a shul? You're going to make him a Rebbe in a classroom? I mean, if the best graduates of Europe didn't understand him, you follow me, in Berlin, what the heck is an American kid going to understand Reb Chaim Heller? You follow me, Aaron? So the Rav raised money, subvented it through the yeshiva. Till the day he died, Reb Chaim Heller thought he was being paid a salary by YU for the lectures he gave. He gave a few lectures a year in the Bernard Revel Graduate School. And those lectures were fascinating. I, as a kid, remember, I didn't understand what was being said, but I remember standing in back to see the sight. There was Reb Chaim Heller. The Rav was sitting next to him. There was a microphone. Reb Chaim Heller would speak for about 5 minutes. You could barely understand him in Yiddish, of course. And then the Rav would explain for 30 minutes what Reb Chaim had said. When the Rav finished explaining, gave the microphone back to Reb Chaim Heller, Reb Chaim Heller continued, and could you believe it? This is why Reb Chaim Heller thought he was getting a salary from the yeshiva. That was all money that the Rav raised, given to the yeshiva to pay Reb Chaim Heller. You want to know, when I first found out who Reb Chaim Heller is, I had a classmate, Izzy Perlmutter. Izzy Perlmutter lives in Pisgat Zev Mizrach today. He's a well-known psychologist here. He was Reb Chaim Heller's anenical. Two of Reb Chaim Heller's daughters married. One did not marry. One was married to Rabbi Singer. Anyone here from Sheepshead Bay? The rabbi of the Sheepshead Bay Jewish Center is the son-in-law of Reb Chaim Heller. He's retired today, Rabbi Emeritus. The other son-in-law was Perlmutter. This they're all gone already. This Perlmutter is an anical. He's my age, my classmate. We were in high school. We were playing outside the yeshiva building on Amsterdam Avenue. Kids playing. And suddenly, Rabbi Soloveitchik comes over. I must have been 14, 15 years old, but I knew Rabbi Soloveitchik was. And he says, Yisrael, your Zeta wants to see you. And he takes Yisrael by the hand, and he brings him, and I follow to see where they're going. He brings him to the Bernard Revel Graduate School. It's after the shir. Students are standing around Rabbi Chaim Heller, and your Zeta wants to see you. This was the rub and his relationship to Rabbi Chaim Heller. I tell you, it was just indescribable. What I told you with the Yad Side Shir, if you couldn't see it, you couldn't believe it. When the Chaim Heller died, the funeral was Erev Pesach. It was snowing. It was an unbelievable day. There were no planes. The Rav got to New York, somehow got back to Boston in time for the Seder. It was Meisa Nefesh on the tombstone. Tova Lichtenstein, Tova Soloveitchik Lichtenstein, always told me that my father picked the tombstone, and on the tombstone it says, my father said, there's only one way to describe Rav Chaim Heller, Rabban Shel Yisrael. Believe it or not, I have a student, Eugene Horowitz, who maybe through a little bit of my lectures became interested in Gedolei Yisrael. He is the man who has now charted where all the Gedolei Yisrael are buried in New York. Now, whenever I have a spare time in New York, we spend a very happy day going from cemetery to cemetery. We go grave hopping. And I took pictures of all the tombstones. I gave Tova a copy of her grandparents and whatnot. And there is Rav Chaim Heller's grave. And just as Tova told me, the only titles, Labriyot, on his tombstone, Rabban Shel Yisrael. Okay, so this is the second point that I wanted to make about Berlin, the question of Rav Chaim Heller, his relationship with the Rav, and how that relationship becomes a lifelong preoccupation. Now, I want to mention something else about Berlin. Wait, I want to see where I have it in my notes. One second. I had something outlined here. But I don't see it, but it doesn't matter. I just wanted the exact details. Something else about Berlin, and something else that's very amazing. The Rav never got involved in Chochmat Yisrael. Never. All the years, I'm not only talking about the Shayurim in the yeshiva. I'm not only talking about the Shayurim in the yeshiva. I'm talking about even outside of the yeshiva, even outside of the classroom. All the lectures that the Rav gave, not once, did he get involved in Chochmat Yisrael. I never heard the Rav once cite a text, a textual variant. Here it is. And all that characterizes Chochmat Yisrael. Not once. What do I mean by Chochmat Yisrael? Yoshua, Chochmat Yisrael, 6 months worth of lectures that I used to give in very capsule form when I used to give a course history of Torah Modern Times in BMT. So how can I cite it to you in just a few words if you don't know what I'm referring to? But let me put it this way. Chochmat Yisrael is when the Jews came out of the ghetto and enlightenment hit the Jews. So a school developed in Germany where you study Jewish topics, Torah topics, from a scientific point of view. In other words, Wissenschaft, das Judentum, translated into English, scientific Jewish scholarship, formally translated into Hebrew, Chochmat Yisrael. Danny? And Ari Israel. Danny? This is what I mean by Chochmat Yisrael. And what do I mean by Wissenschaft der Judentum, Chochmat Yisrael, scientific Jewish scholarship? I'll give you an example. For the sake of argument, Leopold Zuntz, Yontif Lippmann Zuntz, the founder of Chochmat Yisrael, did an entire study of Drashot. It's nothing to do. He didn't do it from the point of view of Talmud Torah. He did it from the point of view that as a scientific Jewish scholar, he was interested Did rabbis preach throughout the millennium, or didn't they preach? And he did an entire study, Geschichte, das Hamiletische Literatur, and that's Chachmat Yisrael. In other words, there's nothing about it that's necessarily yeshiva-like, but it's used in Jewish sources in a scientific fashion, the same way that we will study Greek and Latin literature from a point of view of scholarship. It doesn't mean necessarily we believe in it, don't believe in it. From a point of view of scholarship, we're interested in it. Rabbi Lichtenstein did a doctorate in English literature at Harvard. It doesn't mean that Rabbi Lichtenstein follows every word in James Joyce. You understand what I'm saying? This is Al Ksei HaMazlek, what I'm referring to by Chachmat Yisrael. But it puts tremendous stress on scientific approach, on textual readings, on variant readings, on textual structure, etc. When you walk into a class in yeshiva, you don't start asking yourself, when was this text written? Is this the original text? What do variant texts say? Are there any emendations on the text? That's not it. Masorat HaShas and the Bach, the Gra, you don't get involved with looking for Kitvei Yad. Chachmat Yisrael would look for Kitvei Yad. It's a different ballpark. So the Rav never mentions, it was an amazing thing, never, ever, ever did he refer to Chachmat Yisrael. And yet Berlin in the 1920s was the hotbed, was the center, the focal point of Chachmat Yisrael. If you were Orthodox, you had the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary. They studied in accordance with Chachmat Yisrael. If you weren't strictly Orthodox, if you were semi-conservative, there was the Breslau Rabbinic Ceremony. They studied in accordance with Chachmat Yisrael. There was one institution after another that dealt with Chachmat Yisrael, including a major Orthodox institution known to you as Hildesheimer's, the Berlin Rabbinical School for Orthodox Jews. The Rav never mentioned it. Vayehi Hayom, it has to go back to the late 70s, the early 80s. Vayehi Hayom, I pick up an Avodat HaMelech. The Avodat HaMelech is on the first division of the Rambam, Sefer Hamada. It is written by the Rav's uncle, Rav Menachem Karakovsky, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, who was married to another daughter of Rebellia Feinstein. In other words, he was married to Pesha, to Pesha's sister. He was a brother-in-law to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. He was the Rav's uncle. Kalman and Kalman, don't fall asleep on the Rebbe, not in the morning. At night, I can't wake you up. Wow, they're still sleeping. It's been a hard night. Gentlemen, I look in, it's okay, I didn't wake him up, it's a sign he needs to sleep. Gentlemen, I look into the Avodat HaMelech, and it's a very unique commentary on the Rambam, because Rav Menachem Karakovsky was attuned to Chachmat Yisrael. And in his commentary on the Rambam, you have the Lashon HaLitvish Torah and variant textual readings. It is unique in rabbinic literature. Lo Aleinu, he had many other volumes of the Avodat HaMelech prepared. It survived after his death. His wife and the manuscripts were butchered during the Holocaust. Lo Aleinu. So I look in, and twice I see that he quotes his Vehereni Ben Gisi, my brother-in-law's son, Hagon Hatzir, Rabbi Yosef Ben Nero Yira, that he found Bekitve Yad HaRambam, the Beit Deikan HaMelucha, in the Central Royal Library in Berlin, and he cites what the uncle told him about the proper text in the Haggait Maimonides. And twice I found in the Avodat HaMelech that he cites the Rav, he says, Ben Gisi Hagon Hatzir, Ben Gisi Habibi Hagon Hatzir. Twice he cites the Rav. 1983, February 2nd, 1983. Some of you know or may not know or do know or don't know or don't care to know, but yours truly gave 10 years of his life to the Jewish people in Russia. I'm allowed to talk about it now. It's not a secret. It was a secret. You'll understand. I don't know how they got to me. What's the difference? The Mossad, Mishra Chutz, Mishra Keshka. I don't know how they got to me. Until today, no one has ever told me how they got to me. But I got a phone call in 1980, and that phone call changed my life. 1983, February 2nd, I'd come to America for 10 days to speak at
parlor meetings for a new Russian yeshiva that I just helped organize in 81 here. And now it was growing, more people were coming out of Russia, and money was a problem. My last day in America, I said, I've now finished all my business. Now I'm going to give Aaron Rekefer a day. And I arranged with a student, I still remember who, that he would drive me to the airport from the yeshiva, but I was coming to go to the Rav Shir. Came into the Shir, it was the last time I saw the Rav alive, although I think I spoke with him on the telephone afterwards. And it was very moving and very emotional for me. First of all, many of the students there were my own students. Number two, it was overwhelming to see how ill the Rav was, because I had seen the Rav last in 1978. And in those five years, so much happened in his health, so much deterioration. After Shia, the Rav embraced me and he asked me to hold him. I didn't understand that you had to hold him up. And he was he pushed away his gabayim and he asked me to help lift him and this. And we went back to the room. We spoke in learning for a long time. My stupid student said to me, Rebbe, did you tell him off about his dovish views? You know, I'm a hawk, the Rav is a dove. And my stupid student said, Rebbe, I said, you icebox, you trumpenics. Do you know what it means when I stand before my Rebbe? When I stand before my Rebbe, I become a kid again. I'm an 18-year-old kid standing before my Rebbe. What's with you guys? I'm going to open my mouth to my Rebbe? Chutzpah. You guys don't even know what Tosh Shabbat is all about. You guys, I tell my opinions to. When I stand in front of my Rebbe, I sit there, I shake, I shiver. Shaliva shalom shalohu. They wanted me to tell him off. But we did talk and learning on many topics. Finally, I couldn't help myself. I said, Rebbe, now mind you, the Rebbe at this point is in such poor health, and his mind is no longer perfect at times. I say, Rebbe, I looked into the Avodas HaMelech from your uncle. He quotes you two times in Chochmat Yisrael. And without batting an eyelash, the Rebbe says to me, two times? Four times? Yeah, you're right. Four times he quotes me. I helped him out. I got back to Israel. The first thing I did, I had a student, the Kolel, who again, you don't know who it is anymore. It's a Dor Chadash, but he was a character, Shabbi characters. Yossi Kloisner. I say, Yossi, I'm offering you a prize. Avodat HaMelech, I give him the two sources I have written here where the Rav said, the Rav said to me four times, you know what the Avodah HaMelech is, to go through every line? Take a look in the library. I say, if you give it to me within 2 weeks, I'm giving you this safe for a gift. Within 10 days, Klausner found two more times where the Rav is cited in the Avodah HaMelech. I believe in my book. I believe, if not, I must put it in. I have to now, when I start revising for publication, because the first draft will soon be finished, I must put in all four times into a footnote. The Rav was right. Four times. I couldn't believe it. You follow me, Kalman? I thought maybe he was putting me on, but he like a kid. No, not two times. Four times. So it shows you that the Rav had familiarity with Chochmat Yisrael. It wasn't alien to him. But evidently, he rejected it. In other words, I think I understand the Rav Shita very well. Chochmat Yisrael is good only when you're a master of Shas and Paiskim. To take the place of Shas and Paiskim, to take the place of traditional learning, absolutely not. And I think what you see here is that the Rav's attitude was like the Chazon Ish in his famous letter that I spoke about in the Makorot course 2 years ago when I spent so much time. And what if you find the Ketav Yad? Did you hear my lectures 2.5 years ago already? Kalman, did you hear the lectures? What were you out doing? Hunting for a wife or something? Kalman, 2.5 years ago, I spoke out, what do you do if you find a Rishon today? What's the status of a Rishon? You find a Miri that was never existed before. When I grew up, no one heard of a Miri. Understand what I'm saying? Is it a Rishon? Is it an Achron? New play with this question, Moshe. I think that was the Rav's attitude, that we can't interfere with the tradition. You can't take the Gemara. See, Avraham Weiss, Professor Weiss at the Bernard Rebel Graduate School, used to cut the Gemara up like paper dolls. You know what I'm talking about? You ever read this from? He knew Shas by heart. A genius of geniuses. But by the time he got done with the Gemara, he pasted it all together. This is the way the Sugi should be. This is what the Savroim ran. This is what the Tanaim. This is what the Amorim originally had. This was into Talob. This was put in by a copy of Tehan. By the time he got done, you don't have a Daf Gemara left. So that's where the Rav held No, Chachma, this is my opinion, I'm positive I'm right. That Chachmat Yisrael, all right, you can't deny that Kitva Yad are important. But first you have to master the basic text. Then you can deal with Kitva Yad. But it was amazing. Four times the Avodat HaMelech quoted him. And never ever in all the years I studied with the Rav and all the tapes I've listened to, and I've studied with the Rav for tens and tens and tens of thousands of hours when I put it all together. I mean, just yesterday I was over with the Rav over an hour. So, Ribbono Shel Olam, with all that I've studied with the Rav, I never heard him Chachmat Yisrael. And here in print, four times. Now, something else about Berlin that also deeply affects his life. Hegel. George William Friedrich Hegel, the great German philosopher. There's no question that Hegel was a student of Kant, Akiva. There's no question that Hegel had tremendous influence, not only on the Rav's philosophic gestalt, but I would say on his entire hashkafa, his entire Torah hashkafa in the contemporary world. You'll see why in a second that I'm absolutely right. And you don't have to quote me. I once gave a lecture on the Rav in the early 1970s when everyone in Israel wanted to know who the Rav is. They were first learning about him. It was in Yeshurun Synagogue. And there was a tall German man there who walked out in anger. Wouldn't talk to me. Was furious. How dare you say that a great person was influenced by a guy like Hegel? Wouldn't talk with me. And 20 years later, we met in my son-in-law's office. My son-in-law's his dentist. And Nebuchadnezzar, he had a talk with me. And I was laughing so. For 20 years, we would meet on the street. We lived in the same neighborhood. He would look away in anger. How dare you? Gentlemen, you don't have to quote Aaron Rakefet. The Rav said it in an interview with the New York Times, June 23rd, 1972, in the famous interview he gave the New York Times. The Rav said, the greatest non-Jewish influence in my life was Hegel. Now, what aspect of Hegel influenced the Rav? It's very simple. The dialectical thinking. See, this formulation, which, by the way, begins with Immanuel Kant, but Hegel is the one who gives it a formulation. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And this, basically, is the Rav's life. This is the way he saw the modern world. The thesis, the 3B theory. Help me out, Moshe. What's the thesis? Brisk. Kalman, the antithesis, Berlin. The synthesis, Boston. Maimonides, why you? This is exactly the Rav. Time and again, wherever the Rav gave Shayurim, wherever he spoke philosophically, even hashkafically, even dashanically, time and again, you would always be hit. The thesis, the antithesis, the synthesis. That's the way he saw life. And by the way, as a Talmud of the Rav, in my humble opinion, there's no other way to view life. Thesis, Gush Emunim. Antithesis, look what's happened to the state of Israel. Synthesis, in 5 years' time, we're all going to be Satma Chassidim. May very well be. May very well be. Thesis, Torah and Yerit Shemayim. Antithesis, the Western world. Synthesis, Yeshiva University. Why are you guys laughing? You're going to have to carry the banner of Yeshiva and dignity. But this is what it's all about. Thesis, Torah learning, antithesis, secular Zionism, synthesis, Yeshiva Hesda. Follow me, Kelman? You can go right down the line. This is so much a part of life. You can't escape it. Thesis, Yeshiva dress, antithesis, Chalutziyot. Synthesis, Aaron Rakefet. Part of life. What do you think? I came in Aliyah looking the way I look today. I came in Aliyah. I used to wear a hat to Davin. I wore a jacket to Davin. I used to speak Ivris. Then I tried to raise children. They started laughing at me. I didn't fit in. So I found my synthesis. Outwardly, I look like an Israeli. Inwardly, I'm Kulo Bris. Entirely in the past. That's my synthesis. Understand? This is the Rav. That's the Rav's life. Thesis. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik,
antithesis, all of America, Western world, secularism, Western study, Weltanschauung, synthesis, Maimonides, Boston, Yeshiva. This was the Rav, you have to understand it. And he said in that interview that the greatest non-Jewish philosopher to influence him was Hegel, the Hegelian dialectics. And that became an absolute part of his life. It became a part of his philosophic teachings. As a matter of fact, time and again, we students would joke around that that's Reb Chaim's view. What is Reb Chaim? You would take the Rambam, there's the thesis, the antithesis, the Rambam, derive it, and somehow we have to find a synthesis. We would joke around, you know, but there's a little bit of truth to it. In every joke, there's a little bit of truth. We would say Rebbe's applying the Hegelian dialectics. But we who grew up with the Rav, we knew those words from childhood on. Synthesa, antithesa. You understand? Thesa, anti. He used to say it in Yiddish. First Yiddish words I learned from him outside of the classroom. Thesa, antithesa, synthesa. We knew it right away. And this too was the result of Berlin being exposed to the whole philosophic school. And you can see how this fits into everything I'm describing to you. Reb Chaim Heller, the Demuktiyuk no Shel Aviv, the ability to balance out the Torah world, his heritage, the Western world, the open world, scientific study, etc. And finally, let me handle the last, I have to finish 10:45. Let me handle the final point I want to make today. I want to clear up Berlin. With this, we set the stage for America for next week. Finally. So now we have the great Rav Soloveitchik, great Talmud Chacham, all this influence of Berlin, gets his PhD. The degree is officially awarded, I believe, in 1932, although I completed all requirements and his thesis in 31. He's lacking a wife. And here we're very fortunate. In Berlin, he meets Tanya Levitt. Now, how he meets her, I heard many stories, but now I more or less, from my book, I finally got to the bottom of it. When the Rav left for Berlin, he left with a very close friend, a man named Genachovsky. Genachovsky was the Talmud Muvhak of Reb Moshe in Warsaw in the Tachkamoni. Now, you all know this family, believe it or not. Stephen, you know the family? Do you trust the OU? Thank you. Who stands at the head of the OU Kashrut? Rabbi Menachem Genach. This is Rabbi Menachem Genach's uncle. Genachovsky became a Genach in America. So if you want to call Menachem Genach by his proper name, call him Menachem Genachovsky. This is his uncle. This is why Menachem Genach was very close to the Rav. He was a semi-son figure for the Rav in the years Reb Chaim was in Israel. So they came to Israel together. They came to Berlin together. That's why Reb Moshe, you know, was happy. They roomed together. And then Genachovsky started going back. He was in Poland, came back. One of his trips back, he's rooming with the Rav again. And they come to Genachovsky with a shidduch. And they say, listen, we have a girl. We have a girl for you. So Genachovsky says, look, it's lo ne'imli to go out with the girl, because I have a roommate. Well, we have a girl for your roommate too. She has a roommate. And Tanya Levitt was the roommate of the woman who marries Genachovsky. And Tanya Levitt is set up with the Rav through his roommate. Now, Tanya Levitt's background is very similar to the Rav. She comes from Vilna, from a fine Lumdisha, Litvisha family. Through her mother, she's related to Reb Chaim Isaac Grzynski, the Rav of Vilna. And Tanya, too, came to Berlin looking for enlightenment, looking for the big world, came to the University of Jena, where she gets a doctorate in education. She was a perfect mate for the Rav. An amazing woman. On one hand, she was self-confident, self-expression, what you'd call today feminist. No one put her down. She stood her ground. She was not a woman that you pushed aside. She did not hide in her husband's shadow. To give you a little anecdote,
Someone calls the house in Boston and they ask for Dr. Soloveitchik, and Tanya's on the phone. She says, which Dr. Soloveitchik do you want? Understand? You ask for Dr. Soloveitchik. She's a doctor. Her husband's a doctor. She didn't let anyone push her around. On the other hand, she was the perfect helpmate for the Rav. She brought him down to earth. He was able to cement him to the ground, because the Rav had one tremendous problem. He was a genius. He was a perfectionist. She mellowed him. She enabled him to deal with ordinary mortals. We are all very thankful to her. Because chas v'chalila, had the Rav not married, or had not married a woman like her, he would have had no influence on the generation whatsoever. And here I tell you a personal story that I'm the only one in the world that can tell this story. Every word is true, and it totally illustrates my point. My years in yeshiva, my class was considered the brightest class that Yeshiva University ever knew. There were reasons why. If you know my age, many of my classmates were Holocaust survivors. Holocaust survivors worked very hard to get ahead. All of you know that syndrome. We had very bright boys that had come to America when they were 7 and 8. Some of them you know, like Rabbi Banspiegel. And then there was a whole group of fellas that all of us came from homes that were not Orthodox. And I don't have to tell you, we were not Balei Tshuva, it's a different era. And here I don't want to mention other names, I'll mention my own name. The other people you know, every one of them, they're all famous Rabbanim today, but I don't want to mention it because I'm saying their parents weren't totally Shomer Shabbos, so it's not nice for me to talk about someone else. About myself, I can talk. People like us want to conquer the world of Torah. We're totally L'Shem Shemayim. We put a lot of pressure on yeshiva. We were very bright too. At the age of 16, I was learning Baran Kotla. I chaptoi samasha when I went to a test to get into Lakewood. So I chaptoi samasha. Rabbaran's face, I'll never forget as long as I live, Rabbaran Kotla's pupils were like two little Sifrei Torah dancing with joy that an American kid was machaven to a masha's answer. It was unbelievable how happy he was. So we were bright kids. Halavai would have the head today I had when I was 16. So we started pressuring Dr. Belkin and Mr. Abrams. We want to study with the Rav. We were all done, you know. We were finished with Rabbi Gorelick and Rabbi Volk. And we want the cream of the cake. And we were a bright group. And finally, they announce, it's my sophomore year in college, that the Rav is opening a shiur for college students. And now he's going to give a second shiur, one to the postgraduate in Halacha, and one to the college students in a Masechet. And Rabbi Lichtenstein is coming back from Harvard. He just got his doctorate. He's going to be the Rav's assistant. And this is how I come to the Rav. No, the Rav looked around the room. Believe me, when I look at these BMT kids, I can't believe I taught babies that age. He looked around the room. It's a true story, every word coming. And he saw a group of babies, and he figured, Danny, I'm going to show these guys who's boss, because the Rav was a Terry yet. This is the mid-50s. He was a terror in the classroom. You sat in fear. You know all the stories you've heard about him. He had not mellowed yet. He was still, even with his wife, he was still immortal. He didn't believe he's going to die yet. He's in the prime, all his strength. Looks around the class, and he figured out, I better teach these babies, I mean business. You know, we were too young. Now as a Rebbe, I know I've played games like this over the years too. But I do it with a smile so my students know right away I'm don't take me seriously. So we come back after the first week of Shurim. This is now the second week. And he says, I'll say it in English. How many of you know last week's Shir? Raise your hands. How many of you don't know? What's your name? You don't know? Sandovsky? Lo Yada. What's your name? Don't know? Lo Yada. You know? Kalman, Zogiva, what's up? You start the Shakran, you're a liar. You said you knew, you didn't know. We were in a panic. We were in a panic. I remember talking with Moshe Yagid, Rabbi Yagid of the high school, Jerry Blau. We were talking, we're going to get ulcers. You know, this is serious business. The greatest man in the world is calling us Shakran, writing it down. No, This was Tuesday night. Wednesday, I decided, boys, we got to do something. I took a friend of mine, let him remain nameless because he was too frightened to speak, although he's a big Rosh Yeshiva today. We knock on the door, the Rav's house. The Rebbetzin answers. We say, Rebbetzin, well, we must speak with you. And we're little kids. I start crying. And we tell her, Rebbetzin, we're serious boys. We're not fooling around. But your husband wrote down Shakran. We haven't been able to eat. All we could, last night we just had the toast and tea. We couldn't eat. Your husband wrote down Shakran. We're not going to survive him. She says, leave it to me. I'll take care of it. It's okay. Go home, rest, study, do well in your studies. We're little kids. The next week, I tell it to you as it was Tuesday morning, 9:30, 10:30, till he came in and got to get ready. It was 10:30 probably, because he was flying, so he had to land. He didn't come in Monday night. Monday night he would come in by train. I was 10:30 was Shia. We are sitting there, about 21 of us. It wasn't a big Shia. We are sitting there, our heads are down, we're sittering, we're shaking, we don't know what's going to happen. Rav walks in, takes attendance. Attendance is over. You can cut the anxiety in the classroom with a knife. He looks around and he says, you're a bunch of crybabies. Crybabies. But he never wrote down Shakran again. That Narishkeit ended. Thank God for the Rebbetzin. She enabled him to speak to ordinary mortals. And this I tell you in parentheses, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's son, you have no idea how much Reb Chaim knows. You have no idea how much he knows. It's the greatest credit to the Rav that he raised a son like that, and he raised daughters like that in Boston. And not the Boston of Avner's Boston of today. Today it's no big deal to raise great children in Boston. We're talking about the Boston of the 1930s, of the 1940s. But Reb Chaim is lost to the Torah world. Never married. Can't teach ordinary mortals. Can't relate to mortals. The stories about Reb Chaim and his perfectionism are legendary. He's my classmate. I know him. Had the Rav not married someone like Tanya, where would he be today? Baruch Hashem. This is the greatness of Tanya. Now, if you want to read and get a feeling of the Rav, Chaim Potok, in one of his novels, In the Beginning. Have you ever read In the Beginning? In the Beginning, he describes a rabbi, Dr. Tuvia Shoffman. That Tuvia Shoffman is the Rav. Shoffman, sharp mind. Tuvia is some play on Yosef Dov, I don't know. But Tuvia Shoffman is the Rav. He describes how he leaves yeshiva, how he's frightened away. That's the Rav. Read it, and you'll see what we're talking about. What the Rav was like in the 1950s, 40s, into the 50s, into the 60s, very early. And this is the Rebbetzin. And finally, the Rebbetzin plays a great role in Maimonides. That was, as it was the Rav's baby, it was the Rebbetzin's baby. And she was chairman of education in Maimonides in Boston. Her daughter Atara continues the tradition until today. She was a great woman, Isha Gadolah. I don't have to tell you that with her premature death, in 1967, she died in her 60s, which, you know, even in 1967, the early 60s, it was not an old age. But with her premature death, it's an entirely different era in the Rav's life. That's the start of the mellowing, the start of the changes, everything that Reb Chaim Soloveitchik talked about in his hesped of his father, those of you that heard it at the yeshiva. And then I have to tell you, the Rav of the 60s into the 70s is a pale reflection in temperament of the Rebbe we knew. Who was luckier? We were luckier. Because we couldn't get away with anything. We had to be totally intellectually honest. We knew that the volcano could explode at any moment. We had to be on our toes. We were luckier. As a student, perhaps, the ones of the 60s into the 70s were luckier. But from the total perspective, we were luckier. Gentlemen, to reiterate, what did we accomplish today? We spoke about Berlin, spoke about Reb Chaim Heller, very, very important, upon Reb Chaim Heller. I don't know if you can appreciate what I'm saying. Someday when you know the Rav's story intimately, you will say, Rebbe, you hit the nail on the head. He was the father prototype, the Rebbe prototype. Not a formal Rebbe, but it was the Demuk Diukno. He represented this Demuk Diukno. This is Reb Chaim Heller. The University of Berlin, Hegel, the dialectics. Again, it's going to come back time and again. The interest in mathematics, physics, the Yish Halacha. The wonderful insight I said, which I gave you, how when you look at the Rav in the 30s into the 40s, his preoccupation philosophically is with universal theological issues. The Rav into the 60s, into the 70s, his preoccupation philosophically is with uniquely Jewish issues. The thrust is different. It's a result of the influence of his students. We spoke about Rebbetz and Tanya. The story of Shakran says it all. I can't do any better than that. I lived it. I experienced it. I said it. I was the one. I cried. I still cry when I tell over the story. It's just unbelievable what he was capable of and how the Rebbetz understood us. But that was the reality when we came in contact with the Rav in the prime of his life, the prime of his mind, the prime of his thinking, the prime of his actions. And as I said, at that state of life that he still was immortal, if you understand what I'm saying. Young people think they're immortal. It takes a while until you realize we are not immortal, far from it. And we've now set the stage for the United States of America. I wouldn't miss Sunday Shir when we pick up with the Biskol Hanan for all the brilliant students in Maimonides, in Boston. And I wouldn't miss next Tuesday Shir when we continue with the United States for all the gold in Fort Knox. Gentlemen, until we meet again in health and happiness, a guten Rosh Chodesh, brachot, smachot, and das vadanya. Thank you very much.